Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm joined today by Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved, The Value of Nothing, and his latest, A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things. You can learn more at Raj Patel, that's RAJPATEL.org. After hosting and producing the show for nearly two decades, in 2014 I stopped recording new live interviews, and the show has continued on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, streaming relevant interviews from the archives. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. But with the election of Donald Trump, which means we're now basically for the year 2017, I couldn't resist exploring the path forward in new interviews, how to resist him, how to get beyond him, and so on. And I've done, I think, about 15 or 16. And this is the latest. The others include Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, Erwin Chemerinsky on the legal issues. They're all available on my website, TerrenceMcNally.net, or at iTunes. And also, every week I like to offer a few websites for information on how to participate in resistance and the movement forward. For some of you, this is wildly repetitious, but for anybody else, they're worth paying attention to. And you can email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com, if you want to get these websites or want to ask me other questions about how to get plugged in and so on. Indivisibleguide.com. One word, indivisibleguide.com. Probably the most complete nation-spanning. I think they've got about 5,000 local groups now. OurRevolution.com. Again, one word, Our Revolution, and that's the one that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. MoveOn.org, which has been active for years, mostly online activism. With the election of Trump, they realized that they needed to align themselves more closely with the grassroots, and they are doing that. In the state of California, that's similarly the case with CourageCampaign.org. Courage Campaign, one word. Again, it had been primarily digital activism, but now much more lined up with on-the-ground work. And then two that are very specific. One is called townhallproject.com. And what that does is you go there and you can find out when your representatives are going to be meeting with citizens when they come home from Washington. And so you can go in there and let them know your thoughts and feelings. And Five Calls, that's the number five and the word calls, fivecalls.org, which tells you five calls that are timely for you to make at whatever point you plug into them, okay? So I'm going to start this off because we are here in early January, and I happened to look, and I actually used this quote to start the last time I interviewed Raj Patel, which happened to also be the first couple of weeks of January, I think about 7 years ago. So in his last speech to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in 1967, Martin Luther King Jr. said, "One day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you're raising questions about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalist economy. And I'm simply saying that more and more we've got to begin to ask questions about the whole society. We're called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. It means that questions must be raised. You see, my friends, when you deal with this, you begin to ask the question, who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that is two-thirds water? These are questions that must be asked." And so on this show today, with this interview with Raj Patel, we're going to ask some of the questions King said we must, only this time it might be, who owns the food? Who owns the land? Who owns the workers? Raj Patel has worked for the World Bank and the WTO, and he's been tear gassed on four continents protesting against them. He's a research professor in the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin and a senior research associate at the Unit for the Humanities at Rhodes University. He writes for a range of newspapers and co-hosts the Secret Ingredient podcast, The Secret Ingredient. His books include Stuffed and Starved, The Value of Nothing. He's currently working on a documentary project about the food system with award-winning director Steve James of Hoop Dreams and many other fine films. And his latest book, co-authored with Jason W. Moore, is A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. Welcome again, Raj Patel, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Terrence, thank you so much for that generous introduction, and a marvelous introduction. My goodness, and I think you're right. The last time we spoke, you began with that wonderful quote. But I think the difference is now, when you said it back in 2010, it was still sort of okay to talk about capitalism and think that it might fix itself. And I think now people are starting to see that despite the years of the Obama administration, there's something that even Obama couldn't fix, which is the sort of inherent problems of capitalism. And I think that's partly why we find ourselves in the conversation that we are, and why you've started recording more of these conversations once again. Is it
exactly
that capitalism is a long-term problem that just won't, that can't be fixed by a president that, depending on your perspective, may be benign or less than benign.
Right, right. Now, it wasn't actually that I thought we'd won, and that's why I stopped in 2014. But
I don't believe that.
But
I don't believe you did.
The counterfactual, the realization of how bad things got is why I kicked in again.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to tell people, by the way, that we are recording this conversation Wednesday, January 10th, just in case when it airs, we're a little slow on current events. So you've, as I said in that intro, you've worked and you've protested against some of the same organizations. You've written, you've done all sorts of things. Tell us how you think about your path.
I think my path has been one of trying to find what works to change the world. I mean, I think that's why the website A World That Just Might Work is precisely. I mean, I think that's been my journey since I was five. I saw poverty in India for the first time when I was five, and it scarred me so much that when we got back home to London, I started renting out my toys to my kindergarten friends to send money for famine relief. And ever since then, my path is, well, all right, well, that didn't work. What might work? And for me, working more and more with social movements, trying the World Trade Organization, trying the World Bank, and realizing that they weren't doing much, but finding more that the deep kinds of transformations we need in the world are coming from social movements that are very critical of capitalism. That's been my journey. And so for me, what might work is not charitable contributions, though, of course, there is a dignified emergency among the poor right now. We must give to charity, of course, but long-term fixes are not going to come from technocrats or from large organizations like the World Trade Organization or the World Bank. They are going to come from movements of the poor and movements of people who are thinking for themselves about deep transformation in our society, and that does mean talking about capitalism.
Mm-hmm. And let me, I mean, it is interesting, as we both, I think, noticed, that quote from 2010 was even more pertinent to your current book almost than it was then, because of his focus that it's finally time to start asking questions about capitalism. What I would like people who aren't that familiar with your work, Raj, to know is, can you trace kind of three books and how they build on each other? Stuffed and Starved, The Value of Nothing, and History of the World and Seven Cheap Things.
Well, I mean, I think Stuffed and Starved was an attempt to make intelligible to the general reader the kinds of technical stuff that I've been doing for a while around trade and around food and around international economics. There was a whole ton of stuff that most people didn't know about the way the world food system worked. And so I wanted to just sort of present a kind of potted history and a contemporary explanation for why it is that we live in a world where there are about 1 billion people who are malnourished and nearly 2 billion people now who are overweight. But Stuffed and Starved was kind of an introduction to the food system. The Value of Nothing was an introduction to the economy in general. It was very much a sort of layperson's guide to why did 2008 happen and what is the economy anyway?
Mm-hmm.
But this more recent work is a much deeper dive into that question, a much longer history of how it is that capitalism began. Where does it come from? Whose idea was it? And what actually is capitalism? Is it just a bunch of people making money, or is it something else? And so with Jason W. Moore, whose ideas I'd been reading, and he'd been reading mine, and we'd started sort of, you know, basically citing one another in our academic work. So we got together, and we'd done the deep and thorough academic work around the history of capitalism. And what we wanted to do was write a book that wasn't quite as sort of loose and easy as perhaps some of my earlier work. And so it does require a bit more patience with the language. It is published by a university press, and it is an academic book. But it's one that again, invites readers who don't have any connection to a university into a new world of economic history and political economy to understand where capitalism comes from. And we've got a ton of examples, and we try to make it as easy as we can. But in this book, unlike The Value of Nothing, or indeed unlike Stuffed and Starved, we are very deliberate and very technical about the way that we make our argument. And so it's a much more robust and much more kind of useful, thorough, deep history of the world in Seven Cheap Things.
Okay, and so that a couple of the words you use there don't scare readers away. Mm. It is also, I'm leafing right now, you may know the, oh, it is only 212 pages. It has a number of pages of notes, but it's only 212 pages, and it's actually not even, it's a read. In other words, yes, it's dense, yes, it's technical, but it is a read, and it is not, you know, a 5,000-page tome. One of the things I was going to say also is that in Stuffed and Starved and Value of Nothing, you wrote for the reader and backed it up with academic. This one was for an academic press, but still reaches out to the general reader, right?
That's right.
You're always trying to sort of...
Thank you. You're right. I'm grateful for that. Correction and for that insight. Yeah, I also just get tired of people in the academy writing badly,
yes.
I imagine other people do too. And so it frustrates me because it's so lazy, and it's such an abuse of the privilege that we have in the academy to do this writing.
Yes, and
it
actually puts a bad onus on on you know, facts and theory. You know what I'm saying? Like if you choose to back it up with facts and you go deep and you step back and all those sorts of things, that doesn't mean that you have to be dull.
That's right. And I hope that's the one thing we're not in this book. I very much hope that, and I hope you'll agree, Terrence, that this isn't a dull book.
Right. Right. Now there are places where I had to stretch and I had to stop and say, now let me read that paragraph again, but not a ton of them. When you say here you went. That the real question here is, what is capitalism? How did it start? What does it mean? So, and that definition that you and Jason have of capitalism, that it is much more than an economic system, is that fairly original, the approach you take, or has that been around for a while?
Well, I mean, I think the idea that there's something about the way capitalism relates to nature, you can find it, if you look in Karl Marx, but in a lot of subsequent writing that has come from people who claim to be working in the Marxist tradition, it's kind of dropped away. And all we've done is go back to some of the original capitalist critiques, and Karl Marx was there early on, but there are others as well who observed this about capitalism, that it is about a certain relationship to nature. Capitalism isn't just about how people make stuff and make money from it. It's also a much more encompassing relationship to how humans and the rest of the planet relate to one another. And that's what we're sort of resuscitating in this book, and reminding people on the left in general that, in fact, if you really want to understand capitalism, you need to understand its relationship to climate. You need to understand its the way that it has its own ecology, that it has its own series of relationships to the web of life. And when you get that, you get to twist a little bit more and understand a little bit more deeply the reasons why we have a climate crisis and a crisis around race and class and gender, because these are things that emerge from the long and very deep history of capitalism.
Mm-hmm. And I read an interview where someone asked you this question. If I were to take a single important concept away from this book, what would it be? And your answer was, we are made by capitalism and capitalism can't last forever. Expand on that.
Well, I mean, again, one of the nice things about having the luxury of to be able to do a good history is that we could follow the beginnings of capitalism. So we look at feudal Europe, and feudal Europe is made possible in part by a climate anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
There's a moment in history where, for about 200, 250 years in Europe, there's what's called the medieval climate anomaly. In this period, the weather is more propitious, the winters aren't as cold, and for landowners, it's a great time because all they have to do to get more money is have more peasants working on their land. And what happens towards the end of feudalism is that the weather turns and that there is climate change, a very systemic and end to the medieval warm period. And all of a sudden, it starts getting colder. And so the economic system, which was based on constant returns to the addition of peasants to the land, so the more peasants you have, the more stuff you get, all of a sudden, that comes to an end. It becomes impossible to run that system. And then on top of that, you have catastrophic disease through the plague and through the Black Death. And as a result of these two things, as climate change and disease, the economic system that preceded capitalism, feudalism, comes apart. And it's out of the sort of decimation of the end of feudalism that a number of other experiments are tried, and capitalism wins. But capitalism can't carry on the way that it is, because it is responsible now for massive state shifts in the way that our planet's ecology works. And those state shifts, I'm using the sort of climate scientist term here, but the idea of a state shift is an abrupt and irreversible change in the operation of the mechanics and the sort of biophysics of the planet. And that means that we're heading for a dramatic change, the likes of which we haven't really seen since feudalism ended in Europe. And with that dramatic change, capitalism cannot endure. It's premised on certain kinds of social relations and on cheap food, for example, which we rely on beneficial climates to give us. And every model that we look at sees food prices going through the roof because of climate change. And so when we see this kinds of state shift, when we see the kinds of really dramatic changes that are in the offing because of the way capitalism has behaved, with a historical eye, we can say, humans have been through this before. We've seen human civilizations rise and fall with certain kinds of climate regime. This, to be sure, is like unlike any other that we've ever seen. But capitalism in its current form cannot endure. And so then the question is, all right, well, we humans are kind of wired to behave in certain ways and believe we are, and we've been taught through capitalism that things are meant to be a certain way. The trouble is that the kinds of beliefs that we have come from capitalism, and capitalism's infrastructure, the ecology on which it depends, is about to come off. The wheels are going to come off that system. So then what do you do? And that's the big message in our book, is that it's happened before, and if we prepare ourselves, we can prepare ourselves to imagine the world after capitalism.
Yeah, I know one of the things you say is that when you ask people to imagine what could come next, it is very difficult for people to answer that question.
Yes, I mean, there's the bumper sticker right there, isn't it, Terrence? I mean, it's easier for people to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism.
Yeah.
I know many of your guests have observed that.
Yeah.
But if that's true, and most people think it is, then what do you do about that? How do you encourage this imagination? Well, that's what this book is for, is to be able to point out that with a good historical imagination, you can see that things were different. And if with a good geographical imagination, you can see that there are plenty of civilizations even now that are not capitalist and that that offer us certain lessons in the way that we might behave so that we can imagine the world after capitalism.
Right. I'm locked in a room. It has no windows. It has wonderful pictures on the walls. I think that's the planet. You open a window, you open a door, and suddenly maybe there are other possibilities. I know that one of the ways that you and Jason approach this is you tell stories. I'm a great believer in that. So if I ask you to tell us some stories, and I'm asking you which ones I'd like you to tell, you can take a deep breath and kind of weave, as you do in the book, some of these stories. So the first one is the story of Madeira.
So one of the reasons we talk about Madeira is because it's a sort of microcosm of how capitalism works in general.
And how it was born, right?
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, it's really one of the sort of crucibles of modern capitalism.
Right.
People think that, oh, you know, capitalism, it began in the sort of industrial heartland of England.
Northern England, right,
but,
yeah.
That's right, yeah, and the sort of the steel mills and the coal pits and what have you. But in fact, everything that's sort of important about capitalism today, you can find in the island of Madeira in the 15th century. Madeira, this island off the coast of North Africa, was colonized by those villains of history, the Portuguese. the Portuguese saw this, and Madeira means wood in Portuguese. It is the island of wood. But the first thing the Portuguese come and do when they land on the island is chop the trees down. But then they realize, wait, we can use this island, we can use these trees not for building houses or building ships, but we can turn these trees not into lumber, but into fuel. Because what we'll do is we've cut down the trees, so now we're going to grow a cash crop, sugar cane, and we're going to grow it using cheap labor, slaves, in fact, from North Africa. And then we're going to, we'll discard their bodies and hope that someone takes care of them for free, so we'll bring we'll kidnap women from North Africa and make them look after the men. And then we'll make sure there are enough scraps from the table to feed all those people. And we'll make sure that, yes, we have the trees to be able to use as wood. And we'll make sure that we're able to fund all this because we'll have bankers in Genoa, in Italy, and we'll sell this amazing crop of sugar to European courts and make a lot of money. And through the application of, first of all, seeing that the island was theirs to do with as they will, through the idea of cheap nature, and the idea of being able to get the money at low rates of interest, so cheap money, and being able to have workers to be applied there, so cheap work, and having people to take care of those workers, cheap care, and having cheap food for those workers, so cheap food, and having the idea of having energy available to boil this sort of sugarcane liquor into solids, so we have cheap energy, and being able not to feel bad about any of this because these workers would be able to be subjugated to the crown, so understanding that we lived in a world of cheap lives. All of that made it possible, these seven cheap things made it possible for Madeira to become both the site of incredible wealth and sugarcane production, and within 75 years for the Portuguese to burn through the entire island. So the island of wood, 75 years after the sugarcane, was visited by a range of travelers, and they said, well, why have you called it the island of wood? There isn't any left. So Madeira is the sort of example of what capitalism does, right? I mean, it applies these cheap things to the island. It makes a great deal of profit. It destroys it, and then it moves on.
Okay, before
that story is, that's sort of exhibit A for us.
Yes, and before I go to another story, let's work a little more with this concept of cheap. It's obvious in the title of the book, Seven Cheap Things. As you told the story of Madeira, you one by one labeled how the cheap things or the conversion of things to cheap things, the enabled capitalism to be born there, or early capitalism to happen and make great wealth for people. What do you mean by cheap?
Well, so capitalism is a system that doesn't pay its bills. So we could have just called this a history of the world in seven things. But the idea of cheap is firstly a way of us gesturing to the fact that capitalism doesn't, in fact, pay its bills. But more importantly, right now, nothing cheap lasts forever. And part of what we're pointing out is that, yes, certain things can remain cheap for a little while, But what Madeira also points out is that eventually these cheap things run out. And in Madeira's case, the first thing to run out was cheap energy. After you've burned through the island and there's no wood left, there's nothing left to do. I mean, you know, in fact, the way some people know Madeira now is through Madeira wine.
Mm-hmm.
But Madeira wine needs to be matured in casks, and there wasn't enough wood left on the island even to do that. The casks had to be imported from the New World. So the idea of cheapness is also an idea of finitude, an idea that things are running out. And in capitalism today, the seven cheap things are all, in one way or another, running out. And that's important, again, if we're thinking about what comes after capitalism, is that, in fact, if capitalism is about moving from one cheap thing to the next if all of them are running out at the same time, then capitalism can't be long for this world.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to read, because it's a potent quote, one of the things you say at the end of this story of Madeira: if capitalism is a disease, then it's one that eats your flesh, and then profits from selling your bones for fertilizer, and then invests that profit to reap the cane harvest, and then sells that harvest to tourists who pay to visit your headstone. And when you say visit your headstone, what you're saying there is that this island that was raped and left for dead is now tourists come and see, look, here's where the raping and the pillage took place, right?
That's right. I mean, there's a strange article that we dug up, that there's something called Thanato tourism, which is the tourism of seeing the dead. And I mean, to some extent, that's important, and it's important to recognize that people have died. So a 9/11 memorial, for example, is an example of that kind of tourism. But it's also an exercise in the selective memory of certain kinds of things. And what we wanted to do in that story about capitalism, some people think of capitalism as kind of just a disease that spreads from patient to patient and then everyone dies and that's capitalism. But that's not it. Capitalism is endlessly inventive and creative about death. And about, you know, making money off it. And so that's why the idea of, look, it's not just about a cancer. Capitalism isn't a cancer. It's a process of making money from cancer. And that's a far more potent thing to look out for. And one of the worries about thinking, one of the metaphors of capitalism as disease, the problem with that metaphor is that we forget then that we get conscripted into it. And we get sort of seduced into the ideas of, well, all right, look, I'm not actually destroying anything. I'm merely visiting a tourist hotspot or something. And in that moment, we participate in a certain kind of capitalist activity through this tourism that I think is something we ought to watch out for.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so one of the points that you make, and I know the next story I want you to tell is the Christopher Columbus story, because he's actually much more interesting in his sort of life path than we know, especially as an early capitalist character, if you will. But before that, this notion that you've alluded to, but we haven't quite settled down on, is that capitalism demands, in a way, and really grew out of the separation of nature and society. And you point out that which now is, I would say, among certain segments of our culture right now, there, you know, and one can go back, you could start maybe in the 60s sort of, wait a minute, nature, you know, we've gone too far with this. And then certain parts of the culture that want to bring those two together again. But I think most people might not know your point of view or have taken your point of view of that it was capitalism needed this separation. Talk about that.
It's a really important idea that every human civilization has had a sort of a way of telling us and them apart, right? If it's sort of heathen and chosen, or the residents of the Middle Kingdom and the barbarians, or whatever it is, there's always been some sort of dividing line. But what's interesting about capitalism, and you see it really sort of flourish through changes in the English language, is that in English you get to see how capitalism creates an other through the change in two words, nature and society. So if you're part of society, you're understood as being human and civilized, and members of society were invariably men and invariably English men. And those who weren't part of society were sort of strange and savage and beyond the pale. And in fact, that idea of beyond the pale is a very important colonial term. You know, in the British's, in the first English colony in Ireland, the barrier between the English and the savage, wild Irish, and I'm using the English's the colonizers' words here, was called the pale. The fence that separated the English and the Irish is called the pale, and the English called the people who were on the other side of that fence beyond the pale. So the idea of strange, savage beasts. Humans who are more like animals than they were like members of civilized society. That idea of nature and society, the boundary between the two, is very characteristic and very unusual in the history of human civilizations. And it's one that capitalism has weaponized, and it's become very important to be able to understand that society is over here doing its social things, running around with the economy and society and what have you. And on the other hand is nature, that stuff that we can take for free, that we can perform operations on, and that we can mine and harvest and pollute in ways that are entirely disconnected from society. But in fact, the economy and society are nonetheless embedded in nature, and capitalism necessarily forgets that. It's not a sort of partial amnesia. It's a desperate and sort of central amnesia for capitalism. You must forget that we depend entirely on the web of life around us in order to be a good capitalist.
So, but the notion of the other, the notion that I would suppose is as old as tribalism, and saw certainly eras when slavery was wide and important and so on in the way society was structured. They were able to do all that to consider the other, to enslave the other without this harsh distinction between nature and society.
Yes, I mean, when slaves are, obviously slavery predates capitalism, but when slaves are brought into, are captured, they are humans who are spoils of war, but they're not subhumans. They are always humans. They may be humans without certain kinds of rights because they are, they are owned, but they don't stop being humans in a way that slavery systematically has to dehumanize under capitalism in order to be able to turn people into commodities. Whereas the kinds of slavery that we see in many societies before capitalism is not the kind of social death that modern capitalist slavery involves. So yes, I mean, there's abundant slavery, but it's not social death in the same way. Because in order for capitalist slaves to exist, they need to be outside society. They're not permitted to be part of society, and in that way, their condition is very different from slaves in other historical eras.
Now you're looking back. I'm sitting in this studio looking back, and we say, wow, they needed to make that separation between nature and society, between and I think of it almost as we, the civilized, God-fearing capitalists, and the rest of them who don't count as we do and are more just part of wild nature. But when they were coming up with that differentiation, right, when philosophers, Descartes and wherever he got the idea, and so they weren't thinking, if I do this, capitalism will thrive. What did the urge to separate come from?
I think that again, if we think back to the origins of capitalism, we have lots of examples in Europe of people who are not who are not sort of acting on this urge to separate humans and society, but they lose. Their approaches are crushed by lords and nobility, and increasingly those lords and nobles find that they are able to make money by engaging in colonial conquests. And as soon as that colonial conquest gets going in the beginning of the long 15th century, you find the need for for labor, for instance. And so it's very interesting that in one of the sort of first turns of this idea of nature and society, you find the need for justifying people being savages emerging from the need to find cheap work. And so the church is very, very much involved in the idea of saying, well, all right, we give you kings and explorers the right to essentially enslave people if they don't believe in Jesus, or if they're not, if they don't profess a belief in Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior. And so it becomes, this isn't one doesn't need to posit a conspiracy,
right,
in order to be able to observe that, in fact, it was very convenient for the powerful people of their day to have this separation become one in which people who were understood as savages could one day be brought into society, but only if they worked. And so you have new regimes of work emerging as a way of civilizing people. And again, this is just a way of observing that the separation between nature and society becomes very convenient, and in fact it becomes entrenched precisely because capitalism emerges already not wanting to pay full value for its labor.
So let me see if I'm right here, though. So the church has the saved and the unsaved. And Descartes, whom you cite as quite important in terms of, kind of pre-Descartes, post-Descartes, the way that at least a certain segment of a certain part of society sees things, that he didn't set out to create a philosophy that would serve capitalism. He came upon it, from whatever, the Enlightenment, and then then they took advantage of it.
Well, I mean, I think it was, in that sense, Descartes was a philosopher of his time. But these kinds of binarisms, these ideas of nature and society, were already, being prosecuted in the New World before Descartes, was born.
Right.
So I mean, in a sense, he was a good sort of codifier of,
I got it,
what it was that was in the air, but he did it in a way that made it possible for others to build on that achievement. So this isn't to say that Descartes invented the system that underwrites capitalism, but he was one of its prime exponents and one of its clearest exponents.
Mm-hmm. By the way, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Raj Patel. He's the author of Stuffed and Starved, The Value of Nothing. And we're talking about the ideas in his latest, A History of the World in 7 Cheap Things. You can learn more at Raj Patel, RajPatel.org. Okay, let's turn to Christopher Columbus and his story and how that, how following him and his path sheds light on what we're talking about here.
Well, thank you, Terrence. I mean, the trouble with Christopher Columbus is that he's often portrayed just as the bad guy, or depending on your perspective. 30 odd years ago, he was the friendly Italian who came to bring civilization here. already, his reputation has taken a bit of a knock, so that now we understand Columbus Day also in many places as Indigenous Peoples Day.
Right.
But really what we should think of Columbus Day is Capitalism Day, mm-hmm. Because he was really the sort of uber capitalist. He was someone who understood how money worked. He was born in Genoa, which is really the was a big world financial center at that moment in time. He understood slaves because a fifth of people, 5% of people in Genoa were slaves when he was born. And he grew up around that. He grew up around he was a merchant in Madeira, bringing sugar back to mainland Europe. He saw the importance of cheap work, of cheap money, of cheap care, of all the rest of it. But sometimes Columbus can seem a little abstract. And so rather than rehearse the number of times he appears in the book, he crops up in every chapter in every cheap thing. But let me see if we can just bring him up to date. I mean, look, what did Columbus do? He managed to persuade a bunch of investors on the back of not terribly stellar performance, that he was going to be able to give them a massive return on their cash. And what he was going to do was find new frontiers where new kinds of exchange and new kinds of resources would be able to be extracted and brought back home, and people would be richer than mammon. And what he would do is, you know, he'd borrow some money. Yes, he'd need some ships, but it's okay. He'd pay his workers very badly, if at all, and then he would exploit whatever he found when he got to the new frontier, and then he'd bring it back, and then there would be money for the bankers. But that's exactly what, you know, our modern-day Columbuses are doing. People like Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk. I mean, when you hear Jeff Bezos talk about his ambitions to colonize the moon, or when you hear Musk talking about colonizing Mars, what is it that they're doing? What they want to do is go to these places and create ecosystems of capitalism, so that resources can be extracted and brought back for cheap, and that people will be able to make money, and you'll be able to set up a new kind of system on the other side of, you know, on either on another planet or on our moon. And this is a sort of example not only of the need of the sort of the dynamic that Columbus once depended upon, now again finding form in the 21st century. But also the sort of insatiability of capitalism. Capitalism always needs a new frontier. And people are like, well, there are no more new frontiers in capitalism. The planet is effectively fully capitalist. And that's not true either of the planet or of anywhere else in the solar system. And now all of a sudden we are seeing that what capitalists very much need is, having, you know, extracted what they can from this planet and broken it in the process, they're looking up at the skies and thinking, they're looking at the stars, and what they're really looking for is money.
Yeah, although I would say that one thing you kind of skipped over there, although I think it's implicit in what you're saying, is that when the both of them talk about colonizing space and extracting minerals from space, then there is a literal comparison with Columbus and those folks. But everything they do is to get people to invest, and they're exploring a new frontier, right? In other words, if electric cars is a new frontier, if solar energy is a new frontier, if internet retail is a new frontier, I mean, so metaphorically, it's what they've been doing all along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it is also true that what they've been doing is underpaying people.
Oh, I mean, sure, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying it's the outer space thing is only the literal one, but everything they do is, we'll find a new frontier, we'll pay people very little, we'll borrow. I mean, it's. I think it works in everything they've done already. Yeah. Never mind what they're trying to do. Okay,
that's right.
Okay, the story of another character who probably is more well known to Americans than Christopher Columbus, Chicken McNugget.
the reason we wanted to talk about the Chicken McNugget again is as a way of introducing the idea. It's a very ugly word, but we can come up with a better one, of the Capitalocene. So listeners may have heard of the term the Anthropocene, and the Anthropocene is this idea that there's humans have been so bad about our behavior in the environment that if there's any civilization after us, what they will do is look into the fossil record and they'll find traces of humanity. How? Well, we'll have left radioactivity from our atmospheric nuclear weapons tests. We will have left plastic. There's no now more, but by 2050 there'll be more plastic in the sea than fish. But what we wanted to suggest is that the other thing they would find is chicken bones, because chicken is the world's most popular bird. There are now 12 billion chickens alive, but not for long, because humans eat 50 billion of them a year. And so, you know, in the future, if there's any civilization after ours, they will look into the fossil record and find these trillions of chicken bones. But what we were arguing is, look, these chicken bones are not a sign of humans. They're a sign of capitalism, because the only way that chicken becomes the world's most popular bird is by, first of all, genetically manipulating these things so that they're, you know, the modern chicken is now unable, is so large that it's unable to walk about. The modern broiler is the sort of genetic monstrosity. And we feel free to do that because it is part of nature, and
so
we are part of society.
This is cheap nature and cheap food in one Yeah, in one thing.
Well, it's cheap nature, but also, you know, the workers who will turn this bird into McNuggets are treated incredibly badly, particularly in the United States.
And the ones who will sell it to you.
Indeed. I mean, it's all the way. I mean, the seven worst paying jobs in America are in the food system.
Yeah.
And it's not just, you know, in the fields, it's in the processing plants. And yeah, as you say, the ones who will sell it to you. And then, of course, there's so much injury in the poultry industry that someone has to take care of, damaged workers' bodies. And it's not the company, so it's the families. So cheap care is important. And then you need cheap food, not just for the birds, but for people. And again, that's why, junk food is prevalent in the United States. And then you need cheap money to be able to sell this stuff, and the industry gets subsidies up the wazoo. So does KFC, because every KFC is a small business and they get small business loans. And we're sort of talking about the whole arc of it, and we end up with cheap lives. I mean, the bodies of people and the people who are involved in the this horrible part of the food industry are usually women and people of color who remain, as I say, part of cheap nature more than they are of society. And so, the way that we can have these horrible wage gaps is a sign of how it is that the early origins of capitalism and this division between society and nature persist with us today. And that's why the chicken bones are not a sign of humans behaving badly, but it's a sign of capitalism behaving badly. And so that's why we should call it not the Anthropocene, not the era of humans, but the Capitalocene, the era that capitalism has wrought.
Interesting. So you, although capitalism arises out of humans, you, in some sense, are more specific in where you assign blame here. And I notice in the book, very often you say, some humans. You make the point of going, some humans do this, some humans do that. Because what you're saying is that it's the system devised by some humans to enrich some humans that actually has changed the planet for all humans.
You said it much better than I ever could, Terrence. But that's exactly it. And those some humans, it's important to call some humans, by their names, right? I mean, we're talking about capitalists. Because that way, first of all, we're able to name an enemy. But then we're also able to say, hey, look, not everyone's a capitalist.
Right.
And not every human society has destroyed the environment. There are plenty of human civilizations still alive today that haven't destroyed the planet. And if they haven't destroyed the planet, we can't blame them. We can't label them with the Anthropocene since they did nothing wrong. So I do think it's important to name our enemy, to understand that we are produced by this system, and that we also, if we are to recover from the system, we need to reseat what it is to be human in a world that's not about capitalism, but it is about all humans.
And I'm going to read another a quote, just because it really sums up much of what we say before I move on to the next question, which is, capitalism values only what it can count, and it can count only dollars. Every capitalist wants to invest as little and profit as much as possible. For capitalism, this means the whole system thrives when powerful states and capitalists can reorganize global nature, invest as little as they can, receive as much food, work, energy, and raw materials with as little disruption as possible. That is, in some sense, the ideal state of capitalism, correct?
That's exactly it, yeah.
And what, by the way, before I move on, the one that I realize I haven't asked yet is, you point out that capitalism isn't just economics, that capitalism demands states, that the nature of states changed with capitalism. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, in a sense, although states, the idea of a sort of protection racket for farmers is an old one. The idea of the modern state comes about through the development of capitalism. The idea of the Westphalian state what we recognize as the modern state is again, it's born at the same time as different governments fight and their corporations fight one another. And so capitalism has transformed the way that we think about who we are, for instance. If we think of, we listen to supporters of certain, a certain politics shouting, USA, USA, USA. But what is that? What does that mean? What is it that to be chanting the name of something that will send many young people to their deaths in wars or in, be responsible for some certain kinds of large-scale violence in the name of some greater good? What is this idea of the nation and the state that all of a sudden we believe in? If we were to go back 500-600 years, the idea of USA obviously would have been a preposterous one, but it seems now it's sold to us as a sort of timeless and unimpeachable identity, and yet it's something that's been manufactured and confected in ways that suited a certain kind of class struggle at a certain kind of time, and that we rarely question. And so I think again it's important to look at what it is that states and national identity in particular have enabled for capitalists.
Okay. Another quote: the story of cheap things and the crises that follow their cheapening is not one of inevitability. Humans can and do fight back. Now, you said capitalism is endlessly inventive, but let's talk for the, I'd say, 8 minutes we have left about the way forward. You talk about, and I'm going to throw them out here, and you and then figure you've got most of the rest of the show to explain them. You say recognition, reparation, redistribution, reimagination, and recreation are the possibilities for life beyond capitalism.
So, thank you again, Terrence. I mean, one of the things that we wanted to point out in this book is that the history of capitalism is a history of people and nature rebelling and not cooperating with what capitalists want. And I think that's important because, as you say, I mean, right now we need to remember that it is possible to resist and that it's necessary to resist. But what does that mean exactly? What is it to organize with your eyes not merely to the next election, but to the better world that you want to live in? Well, that's why we're very keen at the end of this book to think about what it might look like to live in a different kind of ecology, not a capitalist one, but something that's beyond capitalism. And we're excited about the movements that modern labor organizations are taking to pair up with, for example, First Nations organizations. Standing Rock, for example, was a really important moment where all of a sudden you have nurses' unions supporting First Nation organizers here in the United States. Those kinds of synergies, those kinds of recognition that, for example, in the movement for Black Lives understands the importance of reparations for slavery, but also of gender equality, and also for basic decent civil rights, and of local control of the economy. All of these things are part of what it is to imagine a world after capitalism. And that's what we're excited about, is that right now, by pointing out these 7 cheap things, what we're doing is showing and encouraging movements to engage in the kind of conversation that is about crossing single-issue lines to a much richer and fuller imagination of what happens after capitalism. So that's where we're at, Terrence. I mean, I think that, what this book is about is, first of all, to put tools, historical tools of analysis, in the hands of people who want to resist. But then also to say, well, look, if we're serious about imagining not just what happens after Trump and what happens after Republicans versus Democrats, but also what happens now that we're in this, this parlous time of climate change and of social upheaval, what do we do to avoid becoming a sort of fascist state like we have in India? Well, then we do need to be thinking not just for the next 5 years, but for the next 50. And there are human civilizations that help us along the way with this kind of thinking. So First Nations are tremendously important in this. But also we have amazing organizations like, for example, you mentioned Naomi Klein, who's been on your show. The LEAP Manifesto is a tremendously important move towards that kind of direction. And in this book, we're trying to find some of the sort of intellectual framework that many of these movements are already talking about, and we're just sort of laying it out as best we can.
Mm-hmm, yeah. One of the things you say is there always comes a point at which societies undergo a state shift. That's going to that term of not the nation state, but the physics meaning of where the state of things just changes. And yeah. Now looks like one of those times. And the question is, are we going to have imagined where we can go so that as state shift is inevitable, we humans have a hand in creating the next state or the next entity, the next set of relationships in a way that works. When let me go through those just very quickly. When you say recognition, you mean?
I mean, first of all, I think it's just important to recognize that there are movements of that are transforming the world as we find it, and also we need to recognize what it is that capitalism has wrought and our culpability in that. I mean, in the global north, we need to recognize climate debt. We need to recognize the historic path of racism that has enabled so many states to profit so magically and munificently on the backs of millions of colonized people around the world.
And when you say reparation, one of the things I get is it's obvious that there could be reparations due for slavery, but you're saying if the wealthy have had the party, the ruins of which make it impossible for others to do the same, that there's reparations to those poor island, coastal, and so on, who are going to bear the brunt of the developed world's excesses in climate change.
Well, that's exactly right. But I think it's important also to mention quickly. I know we're running out of time,
yeah.
but this if there's one point that we're keen on here, that the idea of reparation isn't about sort of finding a calculator and coming up with a number. The idea of reparation is also a way of understanding. Of bringing back a historical imagination for how it is that we got to where we are. If you have reparations in your mind, you can't go around chanting USA, 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 because you would understand that if you're thinking reparatively, there's nothing to be proud of in the history of what the United States has done when it comes to capitalism, or indigenous people, or slavery. And so all of a sudden, you get to say USA, USA a little less, and start to take a more holistic understanding of how humans together might transform the world rather than thinking in these narrow nationalist terms. So that's why the idea of reparation is not just about recognizing, look, I am the recipient of privilege, I didn't ask for it, but I have to take a relationship to it. Like we, for example, men, all of us, have benefited from patriarchy. We have to make it stop so that our children don't live in a world that's patriarchal. We have to take a relationship to that. We didn't ask for it, but we have to take a relationship. We have to make reparations for that. But that's not done with a calculator. That's done with a constant eye to our own privilege and the way that we behave in the world. And that's something that has to change, because it's obvious that it has to change. And again, this isn't a calculator effort. This is the kind of thing that we carry with us, and we work towards transforming collectively so that we understand that patriarchy and the systems of profit from it have to end.
And it seems to me the last term I want you to talk about, and you've got 1 minute, is reimagination.
This is the hard part. I mean, I think that if we're going to live in a world after capitalism, we have to give ourselves the space and the imagination to wonder what that's like. But we can't imagine it alone. We can't just go out and hug a tree and make this an individual act of imagination. It has to be a collective and social one. But I think, again, with the movements around the world that are moving this way, we can engage in a much more collective and genuine reflection on what the world might be like, so that we can find a world that might work.
So again, the website is rajpatel.org. The book is A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. Thank you, Raj Patel. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, Terrence. Really appreciate it.
Okay. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. That's all one word. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Free Forum podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes. You can listen anytime, anywhere. Podcasts include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, etc., etc. We've got about 10 years worth sitting there. And finally, thanks to G, my engineer, to Mark Maxwell, and to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely.